actions we took is against the law in the state of Alaska's eyes, but in the community's eyes, we didn't do anything wrong.
An act of protest on the Yukon River. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 1st of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, caring for Alaska's growing population of older residents who are mentally ill.
My greatest fear is these people will fall through the system and we won't catch them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
The Native tribe in Marshall is protesting fishing restrictions imposed by the state of Alaska. On Friday, six boats went fishing for king salmon during a closed period. Residents in Marshall and other lower Yukon villages say their meager harvest of king salmon won't carry them through the winter. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK in Bethel reports.
Jason Isaac is a village police officer in Marshall, but last Friday he says he broke state law.
So we went out and fish. We got about two totes of kings.
Isaac drove one of six boats net drifting for king or Chinook salmon. In total, about 18 men from the village participated in the illegal fishing. Nick Andrew Jr. is the executive director of the Ohagamute Traditional Council. He also participated in the protest. He says with support from their elders, his tribe approved it.
The actions we took is against the law in the state of Alaska's eyes. But in the community's eyes, it was a measure to feed our elders, our widows, our disabled people in our community. And in our eyes, we didn't do anything wrong.
The run of Yukon kings in the last few years has been historically low. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, have put an unprecedented amount of fishing restrictions on subsistence users. Russ Holder is the Fish and Wildlife Yukon Subsistence Manager. He said the restrictions are necessary to ensure the longevity of the Yukon King Run.
Our responsibility as managers is really to keep the fish runs healthy so that the families that depend on the fish can continue fishing for their children. If we don't do that, this run could be in decline for a much longer time.
Alaska Fish and Game cut down subsistence fishing to just two 18-hour periods per week. Then, for over a week, fishing was completely prohibited. Now fishers have returned to the fishing windows, but their gear size is restricted. Fish and Game is prohibiting nets with a mesh size greater than 6 inches. That makes it difficult to catch the big kings. During the protests, tribal fishers used king gear, and they harvested 100 kings. Andrew says that was far fewer than needed. He said his tribe supports conservation efforts, but the state has gone too far.
This was just an act out of desperation.
At a smokehouse near the waterbank, Andy Boot says the effect of the fishing restrictions are visible.
I usually put away an estimate maybe 75, maybe 90 kings a year for a little family. But we have no kings in our fish shack.
Instead, just 7 chum or dog salmon are being dried and smoked for the year.
We're pulling out a chum to cut. Only chum.
The Shorty family smokehouse is one of the fullest in the village, but there's no kings hanging. Clara Shorty says they'll be missed this year. Her family eats kings almost every single meal.
In the morning, when we have salted king salmon, we serve that with pancakes. It's like our native bacon.
Shorty says the chums are good, but that nothing can replace kings.
Those are really rich in oil. They help us sustain our bodies.
Compared to kings, smoked chum is dry and lacks in calories. As her ulok crunches through a tailbone of a chum, Shorty says her family will have to eat whatever they can this year.
Usually we used to keep the backbones for our dog team, but it's so expensive to buy food from the store anymore, so we eat the backbones ourselves.
As Shorty goes through her chum, three elders silently look on. When I ask them if they have ever in their life seen so many chums and so few kings, they erupt in unison.
This is the first duck salmon, the cut fish, first time. Only me, king salmon, only three of them. Only.
Fiducia Shorty says her only kings came from the illegal fishing on Friday. Once they eat them, she'll be out. She says that makes her scared for her own health. Marshall isn't alone. The restrictions have been imposed on three fishing districts. In the tiny village of Pitkiss Point, very few are on target to meet their food needs. Pitkiss Point resident John Riley says he's one of the few to hang kings this year, but he did it by going around the regulations.
This is the first time in the history I ever used a 4-inch mesh trying to catch some kings, you know.
4-inch mesh is used to catch smaller fish like whitefish and pike, so it's unregulated. But Riley says using the small gear came at a high cost.
Them kings were tearing up our nets.
The village of Imonic near the coast is usually one of the first on the Yukon to finish their fishing. But there, people are still trying to get kings. Marvin Kelly is the tribal council president. He says with only a handful of subsistence openings, he and others are asking for free fish doled out by the test fishery.
People that usually don't go to fishing game to wait for or to ask for fish from their test net are there. So that tells you that there's people are looking for fish still.
The Department of Fish and Game says they will begin to allow subsistence fishers to use their king nets later this week, but the twice-a-week fishing windows will stay in effect. The Association of Village Council Presidents represents 56 villages in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. They are asking that the state drop all restrictions for the rest of the run, but Fish and Game says that's unlikely. Most Marshall residents say it's getting to be too late anyway. Nancy Oney says her family has not dried one king this year.
It's getting late. The flies are coming out. The rainy season is coming out, and there's no way you could cut fish during the rainy season. The rain is a fish spoiler.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Five of President Obama's top cabinet secretaries will visit Bethel next month as part of a rural tour. The group includes Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, Education Secretary Arne Duncan, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, and Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan. They'll be in Bethel August 12th to talk about rural infrastructure, green jobs, and climate change. The White House announced its 9-state rural tour yesterday. It says the secretaries will report back to President Obama after their visits, which will run through September. Other states secretaries are visiting include Pennsylvania and Louisiana. Bethel is the only Alaska community on the list so far. Few other places are having so many secretaries signed up to visit. Most locations will host only a couple of cabinet members. The White House says the goal of its listening tour is to hear about the diverse challenges and opportunities facing small towns and rural communities and learn what the administration can do to strengthen rural America. This year, Alaska overtook Nevada to become the state with the fastest growing population of elderly people. And for the most part, state agencies seem to be preparing for the needs of older Alaskans. But there's one segment of the senior population that's having a difficult time finding the care they need, those with mental illness. KCAW's Shalise Haas reports.
In Sitka, because we're a small town, small in numbers, sometimes we have the heart for something. We want to do it. But we just don't have the capacity, the actual physical, mental, emotional capacity to accommodate.
Oriella Hughes is the outgoing director of Braveheart Volunteers, an organization that supports the elderly in Sitka. She says that while her volunteers are well-trained to deal with many aging-related issues, they're simply not equipped to address the complex needs of seniors with mental illness.
Our training for our orientation is about 6-7 hours. And you could spend that amount of time just starting to touch the surface, I think, on mental health issues.
But Hughes says Sitka is not without mental health support for its seniors. Local psychologists see elderly clients on an outpatient basis. And the nonprofit Sitka Counseling and Prevention Services offers in-home mental health care for seniors. But for those with severe mental illness in need of assisted living or long-term care, there are few options.
My greatest fear is these people will fall through the system and we won't catch them. And we just need to be able to provide that safety net for them somehow.
That's Phil Welsh, director of the Sitka Pioneer Home. He says he'd like to see this population cared for within the state system. But like all Pioneer Homes, Sitka's facility isn't licensed to care for residents with serious mental health issues. And according to the Mental Health Trust Authority, there are fewer than 150 beds in the entire state licensed to care for people who are both elderly and mentally ill. None of those beds are in Southeast. Ron Adler is the director of the state-run Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API, in Anchorage. He says the lack of assisted living beds for seniors with mental illness is having an impact at API as well.
You know, it always takes a problem to get something going. And I think the problem is hitting us now. And I don't think we have been prepared to deal with this population. We have to step up to the plate and start addressing the issues associated with treating these folks.
In the past 6 months, API has seen more elderly people involuntarily committed to the hospital than ever before. That means that judges throughout the state are being asked to commit people for their own safety or the safety of others. Adler says that many of these seniors don't belong at API, but they're slipping through the cracks of the healthcare system and landing in his hospital. He says he's deeply concerned about the trend and has called it to the attention of the Department of Health and Social Services and the Attorney General's office.
I wouldn't want to see that become the norm in the state of Alaska. I think the judges are making those decisions, whether we like it or not, in the best interest of the individual that is being presented to them. But I think that in the long run, we really want to find something else, another place for them to go.
It's not clear what's responsible for the trend, but according to a report by the State Commission on Aging, seniors with mental illness are seeing many barriers to care within their communities. In-home mental and behavioral health services are rare, and assisted living facilities aren't equipped to care for the special needs of mentally ill seniors. Oriella Hughes agrees.
It really takes an upgrading of the capacity of the staff to be able to care for people, not just a custodial care, but actually make room in our heart and minds for a totally different type of population of people.
It may not be the qualitative shift Hughes is referring to, but changes are being made, mostly at the state level. The Pioneer Homes are undergoing a system-wide audit to help them assess the needs of Alaska's elderly population as it grows and changes over the next 10 to 25 years. And according to Division Director Dave Cody, finding a way to care for residents with mental and behavioral health needs is a top priority. He says it will require a huge shift in how the homes are presently equipped. But with an estimated 25% of older people coping with mental disorders, the system can't afford to ignore their needs. Here in Sitka, the topic has received some attention, but most stakeholders agree that the community could and should do more. Again, Oriella Hughes.
If you would go around and talk to different people that are involved with this population, you're going to find a lot of people in agreement that there is a need here. Let's sit down at the table and address it openly, because it's not going to go in the other direction. We know it's actually the numbers are just going to keep going up. We're living longer, and we're living longer with chronic illness, dementia, and mental health issues. So we've got to figure it out. We really have to figure it out.
In Sitka, I'm Shalise Haas.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, biologists attempt to trap an invasive species.
Herring is the best. We tried cat food, but it wasn't as attractive.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Rat poison is responsible for killing at least 5 birds on an island in the Aleutians this spring. It is suspected in the deaths of more than 200 other birds, including bald eagles, gulls, and peregrine falcons. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service covered Rat Island with a rodenticide in 2008 to try to rid the island of its namesake. When biologists returned in April, they found no rats, but an unexpected number of dead birds. Lab tests recently found the rodenticide in the birds' livers. Bruce Woods is spokesman for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska. He says the bird populations are healthy in the Aleutians, but the deaths are still troubling.
It's deeply concerning, I guess, as a management agency that has a trust responsibility for migratory birds and eagles under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act.
Several more bird carcasses will be tested for the rodenticide, but Woods says he expects the same results. The high number of bird deaths were a surprise to biologists. The rodenticide had been successfully used, tested in similar ecosystems, including another Aleutian island. Woods says scientists are still puzzling over what happened and will review agency protocols carefully before beginning any similar habitat restoration work. He says despite the bird deaths, the island ecosystem should benefit in the long run.
I think we still anticipate that the long-term benefits to the island ecosystem and to all of the bird species that have been effectively extirpated from the island since the rats have been there for more than 200 years will be positive, as long as it's true that the rats are entirely gone.
Biologists can officially declare Rat Island rat-free in another year. Only one legal hurdle prevents the startup of work at the Kensington Gold Mine, and mine owner Core Alaska is asking the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to immediately lift an injunction in place since 2006. Environmental groups have said they would not oppose that. Core Alaska President Dennis Wheeler says the company is ready to start work on the tailings facility once the Ninth Circuit issues the legal documents, expected within 60 days. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
Backed by a large sign that read, "Kensington Mine thanks you for your support," an emotional CEO, Dennis Wheeler, addressed a room full of mine supporters.
"And without your steadfast support, we genuinely believe that we would not be here today."
The Tuesday morning gathering was called by the Juneau Chamber of Commerce, some members who pledged Wheeler their help 20 years ago when he first came to town to drum up support for the project.
"This is kind of like cold case."
A three-year-old legal challenge against the mine was finally settled with last week's U.S. Supreme Court decision, allowing the Kensington to deposit tailings into a freshwater lake at the site. The High Court reversed the Ninth Circuit's ruling that the Army Corps of Engineers tailings permit violated the Clean Water Act. The only thing left to build is the Lower Slate Lake tailings facility, but the 2006 injunction stopped construction on the plant. In a motion just filed, Core Alaska requests the Ninth Circuit immediately dissolve the injunction. If it's not lifted by July 20th, the company says production would be delayed well into 2011. Operations now are scheduled to begin by the middle of next year. The company says another delay also could cost an additional $18 million to $26 million, not to mention the economic impact on the Juneau area. The environmental groups that brought the original lawsuit are not contesting Core's request to vacate the injunction. Wheeler believes that's a good sign.
"By this action of indicating they would not oppose the lifting of the injunction, I'm hopeful that SEAC, the Sierra Club, and the Lynn Canal Conservation Groups are signaling that they are ready to move forward and work together constructively now to get the mine into operation and to create these badly needed jobs."
"We're not going to do things like oppose this motion for vacating the injunction, because those type of actions are just going to be frivolous delay type of actions, and that's not what we're out to do."
Rob Cadmus of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council was not at the chamber breakfast. In a telephone interview later, Cadmus reiterated the group's pledge to make sure the Supreme Court decision does not allow other mines to dump tailings in lakes or streams.
"We're not necessarily pushing for the permits to be revoked at the Kensington, but our record is out there, and we've always been upfront that we think paste tailings is the best option for the Kensington. And if EPA made steps towards that, we've always been supportive of paste tailings."
Jim Ayers of Oceana, an organization dedicated to protecting the world's oceans, heard Wheeler's address. He says it's now up to the Environmental Protection Agency to make sure the Kensington protects Berners Bay.
"Dennis Wheeler, in my view, is committed to protecting Berners Bay, and that's what this is about. And EPA is committed to seeing to it, and that's their job. And that's what the Supreme Court said, that EPA has a job to do here."
Wheeler said he wanted to assure Juneau residents that the company will support the town, be a good employer, and keep the environment clean.
"We here in Southeast Alaska are going to demonstrate to the entire mining community that Kensington is going to be a model operation in terms of care and protection of the environment, and an operation that will be safe and clean, of which we'll all be proud."
It will take about 300 workers to complete construction at Kensington, but that startup date depends on when the Ninth Circuit Court lifts the injunction. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The Usabelli coal mine has upped its estimation of available reserves at Healy. Usabelli Vice President of Customer Relations Bill Brophy says the assessment shows an abundance of easily accessible coal beyond the previous estimate of 50 million tons.
The 700 million tons that we've identified is through surface mining, not underground mining. Had we considered underground mining, it would have been considerably more. But as you can tell, we have hundreds of years of coal available, and there's no need for us to go into an underground mining operation.
The assessment reflects drill data on 30,000 acres of land the locally owned company leases off the Parks Highway. Previous assessments only covered a portion of the property where Usabelli currently is licensed to mine. Brophy says the new study was conducted in reaction to steadily rising demand for coal. Usabelli coal production has climbed from 1.25 million tons in 2007 to an anticipated 1.75 million tons this year. Usabelli currently provides coal for 6 interior power plants, and Brophy says the export market is growing.
The predominant increase is the export market. We do have additional shipments that will be going out through the Port of Seward to several different destinations in the Pacific Rim, including Chile, South Korea. We have shipped to China recently. We've had other shipments in years past that have gone to Russia as well.
Usabelli coal is valued for its low sulfur and mercury content, but its 25% moisture makes it heavy to ship.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Volunteers are helping biologists from the Kachemak Bay Research Reserve search local waters for an invasive species of crab. Each month, they check traps along the beach to identify and measure the crabs they find inside. KBBI's Marsha Lynn tagged along on a recent crab monitoring trip and has the story.
It's low tide on the beach behind Pier 1 Theater on the Homer Spit. I slog through the rocks and seaweed to a group of people at the water's edge. They're bending over small steel traps that look like mini crab pots. Judy Hamilton, who now lives in Coos Bay, Oregon, helped start the crab monitoring project while working as a marine biologist at the research reserve. She's back for the summer and was one of the volunteers at the beach. Hamilton explains the project en route to check the last of 10 traps.
The idea of the monitoring project is to keep an eye out for an invasive species called the European green crab, which is not here as far as we know. But because its range is expanding along the west coast of the United States and also up into British Columbia, it's likely, apparently, that it's going to be here at some point. So we want to get ahead of the game, see what lives here, what's supposed to be here, in advance of that. Crab being measured, so take a look.
Axel Gillum holds up this small, furry brown one and identifies it as a male helmet crab.
It's thinner and it's more pointed than the female, which is wider, like on that. So it's a lot wider and less pointy.
He helped check crab traps this spring with his fifth grade class from McNeil Canyon Elementary School. Ingrid Harold is the crab monitoring coordinator for the Lower Kenai Peninsula. She says from April through September, monitoring is done in coastal areas around the state. Harold says the whole idea is to plan ahead and be prepared.
We're focusing on early detection, rapid response, and getting a community of people who know how to trap and know how to identify. And then we're also fortunate that we can look at what the actual local population is before they come here. We're focusing on harbors because they might come on ballast water or hulls. And then also Southeast Alaska is very prone to currents for the plankton, the young crabs, to actually come up on the currents. So we're hoping that we catch it early and they never, ever get established here.
The monitoring is done monthly at the lowest tide. 10 traps were set out by Harold 24 hours before being checked. The volunteers come from far and near.
I'm Norm Stiefather from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Oh, I just happen to be down here when they come along, and so I see what they're doing. That's interesting. I don't see anything like this in Wyoming, so it was a new experience for me.
This is Abe Hartzell. I'm internship at the Kachemak Bay Research Reserve, working with Ingrid. I'm from Alexandria, Minnesota.
Lloyd Hankins from Anchorage. We're just vacationing, going halibut fishing.
The program is permitted through the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
All our traps have escape netting, so just in case we were to lose a trap, they have our permit number on them, and they also have a piece of rotten cotton that will rot away with time, and so they won't become ghost traps and keep catching.
Harold says they experimented to find just the right bait.
Herring is the best. We tried cat food, but it wasn't as attractive.
It took an hour to check all the traps, gather data, and return the crabs to the water. The rectangular traps, which measure about 3.5 by 1.5 feet, fold up for easy transport, which is what the group is doing as they pack up and head back to shore.
There's eight here.
Oh, there's eight?
In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
More than 85 Fort Wainwright soldiers are returning from a year-long deployment in Iraq. Post spokeswoman Linda Douglas says the Task Force 49 soldiers due in today have been providing aerial reconnaissance and support. Douglas says their arrival in Fairbanks today ends a long trip home.
Normally, they will travel from wherever they are in Iraq to Kuwait on a C-130 aircraft. And then in Kuwait, they will get onto a commercial chartered flight. From Kuwait, they usually stop in Europe for refueling, and then from Europe to the East Coast, where they will come through customs and get processed back into the United States. Then from the East Coast, it's a shot usually straight through to Alaska.
Douglas says the entire trip takes 3 to 4 days. Additional members of the 600-soldier Task Force 49 will be returning to Fort Wainwright on 3 additional flights through the end of the month. The larger, nearly 4,000-strong Fort Wainwright Striker Brigade combat team will be coming home from Iraq in September. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Shalise Haas in Sitka, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Marsha Lynn in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Susanna Caldwell is our intern, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others claiming the Society of Jesus, Oregon Providence, has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus, Oregon Providence. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.